For the latest episode of Consilio's Better Places podcast, I'm delighted to be joined today by Councillor Peter Mason, leader of Ealing Council. Thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure.
Brilliant. Now, you've been a councillor in Ealing since 2014 and also leader since May 2021. What made you stand for council in the first place and then go for the leadership?
I, like a lot of people in London, I'm not an original Londoner. I'm from a place called Leicester, from the west side of the city. It was a 1950s built council estate, concrete panel, prefabricated walls. And much of that estate today is pretty similar to the estate that it is to back then. And I remember very vividly as a kid sort of being in that house full of cold and damp and, you know, the critter windows that you could pick the mould out of the caulking from. And it's the type of place in the world that, to some extent, over a long period of time, has felt a little bit left behind. And some of my, therefore, earliest memories were sort of sitting on a bus, leaving my council estate and going to different parts of Leicester for school and for going into the city centre or whatever not, and seeing the world around me change quite substantially as we would travel through the middle class Victorian terraces out to the big detached houses of the suburbs. And I think from a very early age, I sort of took the view that maybe the world's structured in a way that it shouldn't be and that you need to be a sort of an active participant and an active player to make a difference. And that's really followed me sort of all the way through my sort of political journey as much as it has done my professional journey too. And I think a lot, therefore, about how communities are built, how they're constructed, not just in the physical format, but also in sort of the emotional and the human connectivity and relationship context. And I think all of that basically transpired to me sort of wanting to do elected office and public policy and politics in a way that I've done. So, yeah, stood for election in 2014, joined the cabinet not long after, and then became leader about 4 years ago now, and it's been quite an interesting journey since.
So your educational and professional background was actually in planning, I believe, or certainly involved in the built environment.
I'll repeat the joke that I would tell my friends.
So we need to laugh. Hang on,
it's quite a grim joke, actually. So, my educational background when I went to university is, you know, first in my family to sort of go to university as an undergraduate. And, you know, that was an experience in and of itself. Studied political science, but really found myself getting involved in sort of the built environment, public policy, campaigning elections. I didn't have a great time under the Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party. I used to run something called the Jewish Labour Movement. And along with my colleague, Adam Langleben, we took the Labour Party to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission over issues of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And that's the, shall we say, that's the shorthand for saying I had a bit of a crisis at the height of the Corbyn years to think about, okay, what is it that I do? The party's not going in the direction I thought it would be. We're not having a great time. What needs to happen? So I had to make a decision about whether I would retrain as a rabbi or a town planner. And I chose town planning. And I might still choose the other if, you know, all political careers probably end in failure. So maybe when mine does, I'll go off and be a rabbi.
Fantastic. Well, that's quite a career change. If you do, or is it actually respects? No, I mean,
no,
the art of community, it's very much community.
Precisely that. And a big sort of style of what we try and do in Ealing, a big sort of central principle about what we're doing, not just in the built environment, but also in the way that we deliver public services, the way that we work as a council, is very much with the community at the heart. Connected communities that exist together, where you have strong relationships between friends and neighbours, where you can build a sense of community purpose and an identity, is as important as the buildings that people are living in and that the buildings that they're socialising in. And whether that's, you know, great town planning that connects all of that up to make sure that you can do that in space, but then you also understand human relationships, human emotions, that's as equally important part of the mission that we're trying to deliver in Ealing.
So you've mentioned community there, and you've spoken about power and identity in the built environment quite a lot in the past. How do you see that in the context of Ealing's diverse communities and future regeneration? I'm going to touch in future conversation about the local plan and so on. What is your kind of driving ethos on this basis?
So I think it comes from a central principle that we are social beings, right? We're social animals and we exist to live in community. And, you know, you can look through history and you can look through science and you can find all of the data and the empirical evidence that backs that up. What that means in a city like London, in the modern context, in the highly networked, highly socialized context, is that actually we might be a city of 8 million people, but to some extent, we're also a city of strangers, mm-hmm. that we spend a lot of our time on public transport, commuting from our communities into our workplaces. And we might have friends and we might have family networks around us, mm-hmm. but those friendships and networks are probably more under strain and are more challenging because of the nature of how our city works, yeah. because of the challenge of value, because of the challenge of connectivity. All of those things make, to some extent, London a little bit more isolating, mm-hmm. and detached in a way that other parts of the country aren't. And that sounds a bit bizarre to say, given how amazing our city is in terms of the culture and the amenity, all of the amazing things that are on our doorstep. But to some extent, we're leading slightly separate lives. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in some of the way that councils, therefore, have to orient themselves around the challenges that we've got in things like adult social care and children's yeah. social care. You know, we've got a high degree of family breakdown in London because of the exacerbated challenges. And we've got higher rates of children in care. Likewise, the networks and the relationships that exist multi-generationally are also strained too. And so partly what we're saying as a council is, and what we're trying to deliver as our political vision is, we've got seven incredible towns. Each have got their own sense of history, their own sense of purpose, their own sense of mission, and the communities that live within them. And it's our job to find ways of strengthening those connections and making, you know, perfect strangers who might be neighbours into friends and into support networks that can look out for each other. You know, we've just done VE Day, for example. Yes. We're a big fan of street parties in Ealing, not because like we like eating cake and having cups of tea, but because you can get out of people's houses. Older lady who lives up the road who perhaps hasn't got her family immediately around her, and she can interact and have a social connection with perhaps the young family that's living down the road. And there are actually plenty of case studies, not just from the, you know, the Platinum and the Diamond Jubilee all the way through to the coronation and to VE Day, where we can make a direct connection mm-hmm. between a council closing a road and greater connectivity between people. And I think it's seeing our towns through that prism, or, you know, not just as built environment spaces, but places that have inherently got communities of connection that we can build and that we can foster, like, you know, that must surely be at the heart of what we're trying to achieve in our politics.
It drew me to think of a couple of American political things there. One was Bowling Alone, the study by Philip Putnam at the time. And then Hillary Clinton's saying of it takes a village to raise a child.
Absolutely.
And the two separate things that we kind of be, we are more in the Bowling Alone. And you talked about wanting Ealing to be more than a dormitory.
Yeah.
Location.
Not a dormitory location, and
become a destination in itself. But I guess that can be seen as part of that, can't it? Because my experience in London is, you know, I get up early. I go to work. I come home. It's usually 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And you're right. It's a challenge to be a part of civic society. And a lot of people, by the time they come home from work and spend time with their families, and we are losing that connection with our neighbours.
Look, and I don't want to be wistful and sort mm-hmm. of like, you know, think of the past as some sort of golden age that used to exist that doesn't anymore, because there were plenty of challenges that existed, you know, in Victorian Britain, right? But you just have to look at the spatial distribution about how industry and about housing used to work. So go to Southall. You know, Southall's Victorian streets exist because they provided the accommodation of workers who would be in the food and the rubber and the Leyland bus manufacturing companies' mm-hmm. factories. Yep. That's the model.
Houses for the workers.
Houses for the workers who would wake up in the morning and go to work that was down the road. It wouldn't have been great conditions, and, you know, the quality and the standard of life, of course, is entirely different, and workers now have rights in the way that they didn't in Victorian England. This all, of course, being true, it does mean that there was, to some extent, a greater degree of social connectivity, because people were basically in each other's lives. And even today, in some of those communities, you know, we all know who those aunties and uncles are on the road who keep an eye out. Where I grew up in Leicester, it was on a big semicircle of grass. It's big green. The council have now put a car park on that green, which is not great. But you know, it was a semicircle of grass. And as a kid, it used to look massive. And that was our playground. That is where the kids from the council estate would come. And all of the people who lived on that green, all of the families, all of the mums and dads, they didn't have much. Mm. And nobody was responsible for looking after the kids who were on that green playing out, but everybody was responsible. Yep. And in the summer months, the chalk ices and those little 10p fruit tubes would come out, those, you know, the ice mm-hmm. lollies,
yep.
and everybody would sort of share. And I think part of the bit that's missing in our politics at the moment is, if you like, the ability of politics to deliver that yep. common space, that common ground mm-hmm. where people from different walks of life, from different families, different communities can come together and build those social connections and those dependencies.
Yep.
And the more that we can do that, actually, the more that we can deal with some of those populist trends in politics at the moment mm-hmm. that are actually trying to rip communities apart rather than stitching them
back
together. So
is that the kind of foundation for the 20-minute neighbourhoods, which form a big part of a local plan, which has been submitted to the inspector now and was waiting for a final sign-off or approval, I assume. So they've come into a bit of criticism, 20-minute neighbourhoods. I think it's Oxford. It's quite remarkable, the discourse on it online.
Yeah, it's crazy.
quite down the rabbit hole, isn't it, in terms of where you go with that? But you've just explained it quite well in terms of what you see. Do you see this as a central part for Ealing and also maybe elsewhere in London?
Yeah, look, I think the way that we think about the built environment and the way that we think about how we sort of structure that and how we facilitate it in Ealing is very much through a polycentric prism. Yeah. We'll get into that, I'm sure, when we talk about mm-hmm. the local plan and growth pressures, where they've been. But look, you know, there's lots of conspiracy theories out there about what a 20-minute neighbourhood is.
Quite bizarre, I must admit.
This is like, you know, Checkpoint Charlie on every mm-hmm. street corner. I mean, it's bonkers. It's ridiculous. The fundamental principle is, when you walk out of your house, you should be able to go down the road to access groceries. You should be able to drop off your dry cleaning. You should have a GP surgery that's close by. You should be able to do the basics. Mm-hmm. You know, you should be able to go and get a coffee, you know, a bag of fish and chips if you really want one. These things should be on our doorstep. And rather than the prevailing model in London, perhaps over the last couple of decades, that's seen that commuting pattern reinforced and our communities hollowed out of the value that could otherwise be within local communities, mm-hmm. that we need to start seeing a bit of a resurgence of that. Shopping parades did incredibly well during COVID mm-hmm. because people were more local. The central activity zone suffered, of course it did, as a consequence of people being in their communities longer. But there was a bit of a recalibration about retail and about local shopping parades as opposed to major high streets. I think what we're trying to say is, let's just keep a bit of that. We don't want to be wistful. We don't want to, you know, try and pretend that the world's completely different to the way that it was. We can see trends reassert themselves. Mm-hmm. But we just want people to have strong, connected communities in local places. And if that means, you know, Perivel needs some extra effort to help mm-hmm. it develop in the right way, then that's what we're going to do.
So in terms of development, the local plan is looking for nearly 22,000 homes in 10 years with a 50% affordable ambition. You're one of the few London boroughs which is there or thereabouts on its numbers. Now, there is a bit of a London-wide slowdown in residential development. I imagine most boroughs will be affected by that. But up until now, you're hitting those numbers. How have you been able to do that in Ealing in a way that other boroughs haven't?
So we've always been incredibly committed to delivering genuinely affordable homes. Mm-hmm. In the last administration, we set ourselves a target of 2,500. We exceeded that target in 4 years. That might have been about market condition. But look, we've been really clear that as a borough that sort of sits on the inner outer London border, that our people want homes and our people want to be able to know that their kids and their grandkids can grow up in communities that are close by. Yeah. Of course, presents challenges. And we do have some advantages. We are a big borough. We're London's third largest in terms of population. And we've still got regeneration happening. Of course, we've had the infrastructure investment, which has been incredible in the context of the Elizabeth Line, mm-hmm. HS2, Old Oak Common, Park Royal. All of this is happening. But it's about a commitment to saying, you know, we are pro-growth, we're pro-housing, we're pro-industrial growth, we're pro-jobs growth. But all of that has to be stitched into a programme. And therefore, we've developed a planning department, you know, that's considered, you know, a platinum planning service. The speed at which we're able to process our planning applications and give the market assurance about what they need in order to bring forward homes is incredibly important. But we also maintain incredibly high standards about what it is that we want, what we're seeking to achieve and how we want people to work with us. But it starts from that fundamental principle that, you know, if you want to see housing growth and you want to see jobs growth, then you have to be invested in making that happen.
could this have happened without the Elizabeth line, do you think? In terms of the ambitions you have and also the housing numbers,
yeah.
I mean, the Elizabeth line in Ealing must have been a huge game changer for you.
I mean, it's certainly a game changer. Look, the sort of the ingredients in West London are right in any circumstance. You know, why did the Elizabeth line go in and why is it connected to certain parts? Well, you know, there's a giant, great big airport.
Yes.
You know,
it's just a bit to the
just
west,
a bit to the west
of
us, yeah. Right? You know, it's the largest port in the context of British goods exports.
Yep.
I think, you know, even in some of the more traditional shipping docks, it's huge. And likewise, the reason that we do so well to some extent is because businesses will honestly make a decision about where they're based and where they want their people based according to that line. Some of those strengths that we've got as Ealing also existed long before the Elizabeth line. We've got the longest running film studio in the world. You know, we were producing movies in Ealing.
Before Donald Trump's 100% tariff.
before his tariff, but equally before, you know, before Hollywood even existed, we were producing movies. And likewise, Park Royal's been the breadbasket of London, you know, feeding the city for, you know, over 100 years. So the raw ingredients are there. The connectivity is good. It's fantastic. It does have some disadvantages that do have to be sort of worked through as a consequence of some of the changes that we tried to make in the local plan and also about our collective appetite for infrastructure investment. You know, one of London's greatest challenges, of course, is it subsumes an awful lot of our infrastructure investment. Yes. It pushes up land value and we invariably end up displacing wealth rather than displacing poverty rather than redistributing wealth.
Your point about Park Royal being the breadbasket for London is very interesting because I don't think many people realise, and they see it as an easy win when they say, oh, here's some industrial land.
Yeah.
Let's develop that for housing. But my father-in-law used to do imports and picked up at Heathrow and we then delivered. It was all
completely
serviced around.
All part
there.
Of that
it's
network.
It's a huge part of London that people don't know about. And it's... I see politicians and some others say, oh, it's just industrial land.
But this is absolutely the central question that London now has to face in the context of our growth pattern, in the context of how we deal with the housing crisis, about how we think about how we, you know, put more money into the pockets of average Londoners who quite frankly need a break, which is industrial land.
Yeah.
For decades and under the last mayor, when Boris Johnson was the mayor of London, you know, Ealing was told, lose your industrial land. Yeah. Give it over to residential-led development. We need you to be a dormitory suburb to the central activity zone. Our future economic output is going to continue to be the financial services sector and the professional services that exist in central London. You just need to put people on the train and we'll have your labour. It can't work like that. Mm-hmm. It honestly, a country that can only survive on financial services or on professional services, where we don't export anything of great value, you know, is a recipe for disaster. What London actually needs to see is some of the innovation that's already happening extend all the way out into a more polycentric way of growing our city that recognises that production and production still happens. You know, whether it's in the creative sector, whether it's the movie studios and the television studios that are popping up all over Old Oak Park Royal, or it's the innovation science that's happening in places like Imperial that's extending out to Hammersmith and then extending into Park Royal, where they're opening factories to be able to test and produce at scale the inventions that they're creating in their sort of central campus in central London. We have to make sure that we're preserving industrial land because it'll be in those movie studios, it'll be in those clean labs, it'll be in those kitchens that we innovate the next sort of iteration and the next generation of production that happens in this country. And people want to live close to them. People want to be able to access employment locally. And so we can, you know, we can get rid of all of London's industrial heartlands and build loads of tower blocks there. But where are they going to work?
Where are they going to work? And really, is that how you see what's been called the West Tech Corridor? Kind of moving into the old industrial space in the sense of old industries which perhaps aren't to our national strength anymore.
Yeah.
But that space should be preserved for employment.
Yeah.
And actually, it's this West Tech Corridor with Imperial College really leading the charge. How Ealing can benefit maybe over the next 50 years in terms of this keeping this industrial land?
Yeah, completely. And one of the things that we've always attempted to do at Old Oak Park Royal, particularly with the Mail Development Corporation there, and it's great that actually the mood music is changing from OPDC, mm-hmm. that they're very much now in the business of thinking about their contribution to London's economy and not necessarily just as an infrastructure-led housing regeneration zone. But they're really in the business of thinking about, okay, how do we come true to what Ealing's commitment's always been to preserve our industrial land at Old Oak? Doesn't mean that it can't intensify. And actually, there are some really interesting models of industrial intensity that are happening in other parts of the world that mean that we don't just need to have single-story sheds, but mm-hmm. that we can think about actually how we bring multiple different uses mm-hmm. of industrial, and intensify the area and make it work better. But that absolutely, it's the job of the OPDC, it's the job of Ealing to work with people like Imperial to really think about what those needs requirements are in the long term. Mm-hmm. If we think that different forms of technology, different inventions, different biomedical sciences, different forms of creative industry are going to be our growth sectors, doesn't mean all of them are going to win. No sector works to assume that everything's going to be a success. Businesses need the space to expand, to mm-hmm. test, to learn, to try. We need to make sure a lot of that's happening in London and that London serves the rest of the country in that mission too.
It's a question I asked Councillor Cowan when we interviewed him last month was, what are you doing to ensure that the jobs which are created, Ealing residents have the skills needed for these new jobs? Yep. Because there is a perhaps lazy assumption, but a lot of these are almost like postgrad type jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
People spinning off businesses from Imperial. Yeah, they tend to be extremely very well educated at quite expense jobs. But there's an awful lot more about that to London. You just said it's a very disparate community. So how are you in? Well, no, it's going to be quite a challenge. What are your thoughts on how to ensure that Ealing residents don't miss out
on
these opportunities?
We've sort of got like three dual challenges in the labour market. Number one is fundamentally the labour shortage, mm-hmm. full stop. Yeah. And that, people don't like to talk about it, but that's absolutely a consequence of Brexit. That's absolutely a consequence of the tightening up of migration, which will be music to some people's ears. But, you talk to businesses, you talk to people who employ, actually it's become a greater challenge. The second is that we've got some incredibly high rates of joblessness in London as a consequence of people facing serious barriers in terms of medical conditions, whether that's physical or mental health, and a generation of young people for whom have come out of COVID, stunted with their educational progress because of a pandemic, who need a little bit more of a helping hand into the labour market. And the third is the cost of living in London is just so extreme that it's incredibly difficult for people to be able to afford to live in the city. Mm-hmm. And we absolutely need to address both the cost of living, but also the mm-hmm. pay that people are getting. They're the fundamental drivers. We've been terrible, certainly over the last 14 years, but historically, about being able to connect up the skills that people need in the industries that are growing in London with the education and the skills training mm-hmm. provision that's happening in our further education colleges and the esteem that alternative mm-hmm. methods of education get outside of higher education. And what we're trying to do, not just as a borough, but working across all of our partners, the West London Alliance, we're going to be launching some work later in the week with the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions around some of our trailblazers to mm-hmm. remove the barriers for people who've got long-term, musculoskeletal conditions, get them back into work if they want to work. Mm-hmm. We've got to make sure that the system connects the opportunities up with the skills provision that exists there. It's the million sort of pound challenge that we've always had, but we really need to come good on if we're going to be able to do what we need to do.
Part of the challenge is educational courses are looking backwards. And that's not a criticism. It takes so long to get a course up and running. And the technology and the job opportunities are moving and evolving at such a rapid rate. To connect the two together is always going to be a bit of a moving feast and a challenge.
And most employers, when you talk to them, they don't say, well, we need somebody with a, X qualification in specific skill sets.
Yeah, yeah.
What they want is work-ready people,
aptitude
critical thinking, awareness, initiative. Mm-hmm. These are all valuable life skills that you can get in different sectors and different industries and move quickly. But I think what we've got to recognise, though, is that there are plenty of barriers that sit often in people's way whether it's about seeing themselves in particular industries, thinking that there are opportunities that are available to them, mm-hmm. Or indeed making sure that we sort of remove the barriers that stop them from being able to access labour markets or from training. Yeah. And that's there's going to be a lot of focus on that in the year and the years ahead.
You mentioned affordable housing, and it's maybe people outside London don't appreciate just quite the challenge of any level of affordability at the moment. So a lot of attention is spent on social housing. Those at the top can look after themselves. A lot of the jobs are being created. Let's say they've got a salary between 40 and 80,000.
Yeah.
Again, for people outside London, that does not get you much in London, certainly as a single person. Yep. How do you see the provision for that group who often don't get talked about by politicians or
we talk about them all the time.
Yeah.
Right. That is fundamentally who we're in the business of making sure get roofs over their heads. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that, my family had a roof put over our heads when we were in temporary accommodation and homeless when mm-hmm. I was a kid, that experience tells me that, you can fall on hard times and you need the support of local government, you need the support mm-hmm. state at your back to make sure that if you fall through the cracks, actually there's going to be somebody there to catch you. And every Labour leader of a council will know their numbers. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, I have 7,500 families on my housing waiting list. Yep. I've got over 3,000 families currently in temporary accommodation. And 1 in 26 children in London today mm-hmm. are living in temporary accommodation.
Yep.
That's one child in every classroom mm-hmm. in this city who are experiencing sort of the trauma and the torment that my mm-hmm. family went through when we found ourselves homeless. And that's the central principle. And I think what that does, therefore, in the current debate about the housing crisis, really focus and probably challenge some of the assumptions that are being made mm-hmm. in that housing crisis and how we should tackle it. So should it be the case that a market downturn that has been caused by sky-high interest rates mm-hmm. And inflation in build costs and in labour costs and increased regulation, should that give way, therefore, to developments that provide lower quantums of genuinely affordable housing? Or should we maybe, controversially, hold off, actually, and find ourselves a situation when we can't deliver at volume? What good is a development of 100% non-affordable homes to my housing waiting list mm-hmm. when in a few years' time, if we can make a material difference and an impact to the overall situation, whether mm-hmm. it's inflation, interest rates, build out rates, that we have the ability to deliver genuinely affordable homes when I want the genuinely mm-hmm. affordable homes. And we've equally got to therefore think about the patterns of growth in London too. I talked about it a little bit earlier on in the context of expensive bits of infrastructure sending off workers into central London and ratcheting up the land values in a place like Ealing. Well, if that is the model and that's baked in mm-hmm. and we continue to struggle to get developers to deliver at quantum, does London need to think more clearly and coherently about releasing some of the grey belt that we've got, mm-hmm. crappy bits of land covered in concrete, toilet blocks and car parks to great, to enable greater connectivity to some of our green spaces? And is London in the situation that it was in the 40s and the 50s, where we actually might need to think about urban extensions, new towns, mm-hmm. and a better settlement for the housing crisis as we currently see it? Because we run the risk of, deregulating the planning system mm-hmm. in order to reach the goal of, starts on site and housing numbers. But if those housing numbers can't be accessed by the people who really need them, the people who are going to be the fuel of the engine of our economy and work in the places that we need them to work, well, what are we doing?
I think I come back to the point: what is affordable housing?
Yeah.
Because I believe you have announced a fund to £150 million fund.
Yeah.
I know Enfield's done something similar for its housing gateway to pick up properties off the market to ease the temporary accommodations, which on a human and financial level is just.
Yeah,
horrific for the council and the individuals involved. But I'll come back to that.
That's about being a counter-cyclical move in a way mm-hmm. that we're able to do right now that normally would be the case for housing associations.
Yes. You're stepping into
the bottom of the market. You step in. The state's there to be able to pick up, what are distressed assets at a lower cost price than the developer will be able to stick out onto the open housing market, and we're able to do that because we've got a little bit of capacity in the system. Mm-hmm. you know, housing associations, you talk to them. Yeah. I'm sure people on your podcast know this incredibly well. Everybody's overstretched. Correct. And they can only do it to a certain extent. And that will only take us so far in current distressed assets that need to be sort of deployed. It's not going to make the material impact to the starts on site and to the quantums of affordable homes that we need to have in London's pipeline if we're going to address the crisis.
Yeah, I guess it's the affordable element. Let's say we've got 100% private, or there's housing waiting list, people need social housing. Yep. It's that middle ground of people as going back to earning, say, 40. Do you see build to rent as kind of, I think home ownership for people on that salary without the bank of mum and dad is going to be extremely difficult, but we need to keep people earning those salaries in London. Is that co-living? Is it built to rent? Yeah. What do you see in Ealing as the product that needs to come forward to attract people in that salary bracket to live in Ealing?
So we've always been open to innovation in Ealing. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had the very first build to rent formal build to rent scheme that came forward at the rehearsal rooms in North Acton. And we've got big developments, Greystar's build to rent model in Greenford as well. So we've always innovated. Sometimes it hasn't worked. And if you were to probably do a viability assessment on a build to rent model of some of those early build to rent schemes, I think, the 40-year mark, I think the public sector lose out an awful lot on behalf of residents because of the nature of that model. Look, the fundamental question is how you get people an affordable home that they can sort of survive in more than just survive in a city like London, but they can also thrive. You know, we can be creative and we can be experimental about the models that are brought forward. I think what it does necessitate is a bigger and broader question about London's housing growth and about where it goes and about the role that the South East and some of our neighbours immediately on the outskirts of London, how they contribute towards that challenge too. Mm-hmm. You know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, we were quite literally building the London boroughs of Barking and Dagenham and parts of East London and the new town settlements on the periphery, places like, Harlow and Crawley and Swindon, to some extent, certainly Stevenage. You know, these were places that were built to deal with the housing crisis of its day in London. Mm-hmm. And we have to have a better rational conversation about how we meet London's housing need, not just within the red line.
Yeah.
Within the red line, it's going to be increasingly difficult because of all the things that we talked about, but how we also look to the rest of the southeast to support that mission too.
We're waiting to see the new town task force and the sites it identified, because London is clearly spilling outside of its borders, or needs to spill outside of its borders, but it's currently constrained by Greenbelt, an artificial constraint.
Well, Greenbelt and local authorities that perhaps don't want any development and the lack of regional spatial strategies and planning that have prevented us from having had that conversation. I always find it incredibly bizarre that you can get a planning consultant to write you a schmar and a schlar and they'll produce both exactly the same number, despite you being immediately on the boundary of London.
Does sound you're asking for local government to talk to each other in a growing up way to work together and plan the needs outside and inside London.
Well, I'm certainly asking, devolved combined authorities, which we're going to get an awful lot of in the coming months and years, to have better, more strategic conversations about how a city like London grows and about what, the benefits that London can bring to the rest of the country by way of actually getting some development, some value. Mm-hmm. I'd love to be in a situation, quite frankly, where, the London Borough of Ealing, with its huge housing demand, with people being placed into temporary accommodation, not just in Ealing, but in other parts of West London, and in some cases outside of London altogether, as every London borough is currently doing, wouldn't it be better for us to have a more strategic conversation about how we look at urban extensions, about how we look at new towns, how we work in partnership with others to deliver on housing growth, places like, places on the Elizabeth Line that perhaps have got plenty of land around them that hitherto have not been unlocked.
And it takes a lot to shock the world of local government in London, I think. I think the proverbial eyebrow was raised by the letter that was sent by London councils, of which you were a signator, to the GLA, saying, and apologies, we're going to get in the weeds a bit here to our listeners, in terms of combined authorities and the fact that local authorities in the combined authorities, which are now going to be set up or currently exist and to be amended, will have local government involvement. But in London, it's actually going to be the outlier, because even though all these combined authorities are being told to follow the SDS model of the London plan, governance structure is very different. Do you think that local authority leaders in London should have more of a say at that strategic regional level than the current GLA Act permits?
So, I mean, with apologies to your listeners, because we're now going to get into the total weeds of local government powers and responsibilities. So let's take a step back. Mm-hmm. Under the previous government, we saw a proliferation of combined authority mayors mm-hmm. working with councils that have made a real impact and a real difference to the way that our country is governed. But I think to some extent, and I think it's acknowledged even by the Tories mm-hmm. as much as is Labour, you know, some of the ways that those models were set up were in full cognizance that those mayors were likely going to be Labour.
Yep.
And that those Labour mayors needed a veto and a break on them that prevented them from doing what they wanted.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the case of places like Manchester, you know, you've got basically unanimous voting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if a mayor wants to bring forward a strategic document, he wants to take a big decision, and unfortunately I'm using the pronoun he, because until Tracy Braben unfortunately. So that mayors would effectively be able to be constrained by a single council that can stop mm-hmm. them in their tracks. What we've had in London since the GLA is a very different scenario, in which the big strategic decisions on things like, you know, planning, on mm-hmm. on strategic transport, all of the things that rightly and should be at a citywide level, mm-hmm. the mayor rightly has the ability to influence, and they are the final decision maker. You could not have a scenario in which the London Borough of Ealing could veto the London plan because it's got something in it that we don't like.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that's not the case, and we shouldn't want that, and we shouldn't advocate it, not least because the direction of travel for combined authorities outside of London mm-hmm. is probably going to be more towards the mayoral model in London than it is anything else. And that's entirely right. And I don't think there's a single leader in London who wants to constrain or curtail the true strategic powers of the Mayor of London in governing our city correctly. Entirely right. So the letter didn't say we want to control planning. Mm-hmm. Far from it. I think what it said was that in the areas of governance that other combined authorities have outside of London, on things that are really important, that we're the delivery mm-hmm. agents on the ground, whether it's skills training, whether it's on public health, you know, these are things that we need to be able to be at the table making decisions with the mayor. And to be frank, like, we already are, but we're doing it under a voluntary agreement as opposed to a more formal mechanism. And I think London's basically saying, you know, if we're going to take this opportunity to mm-hmm. really give power and control back to local communities through devolution and through local government reform, then let's just make sure that in London, we're not falling behind the rest of the country. We want a bold, powerful mayor that can get things done mm-hmm. as he is doing, tackling those really knotty challenges around, you know, pedestrianisation of Oxford mm-hmm. Street, you know, the next generation of infrastructure investment, the Bakerloo line extension, the West London Orbital, all of those knotty challenges that can only be solved at a citywide level. Mm-hmm. We also just want to make sure that we're at the table too, having the right conversations and supporting a city that needs to grow in the way that it needs to grow.
So for things like skills delivery, that does seem to make sense to be done far more at a borough level in
absolutely.
Terms of how it's implemented.
Yeah, completely. Look, you know, we've got our own, you know, London's a huge city, 8 million people, mm-hmm. even more millions that come in every day. We've got, you know, economic networks. West London is bigger than, Leeds and Manchester combined. Mm-hmm. It's huge. And that's just one sub-region of our city. Mm-hmm. We need delivery on the ground that's reflective and responsive to local communities and to local community needs. But of course, that's got to be done in full cognizance of what's great in West London, what's great in East London, what's mm-hmm. great in North and what's great in South. You know, and only a strategic mayor with the powers that they need is able to sort of conduct that choir. Mm-hmm. We need to be belting to the rafters to deliver it.
So with Old Oak Common and HS2 and Elizabeth Line, can you see a situation where the focus of London shifts a bit from maybe East and Central over to West? I'm not going to say West London's a forgotten part of London, but when you think of London life, you do think Central and maybe the East, Shoreditch way. But increasingly, there's a lot of infrastructure money being spent on West London. And following that, surely will come, well, who knows, but something will come. And can you see West London having more of a voice?
Our city is growing, undoubtedly, and that means the boundaries of the central activity zone, that sort of, you know, mm-hmm. central pool of value and, you know, economic power and generation of sort of product and opportunity, that is expanding, you know, undoubtedly. It's expanding, but it's also changing. And mm-hmm. to some extent, those are some of the tensions that we do see in parts of central London about, you know, the experience economy versus the needs and requirements of people who live there. And actually, if we're going to see a revival of central city living, even more so, that's a bit fairer and a bit more open. You know, Manchester's story is the story of a city that revived itself mm-hmm. by bringing, you know, residential communities back into the city centre. You know, if we're going to start seeing that take off to a degree that it probably ought to, in a way that maybe we have challenges now on things like, you know, value and who gets to live in those homes, then we're going to have to flesh out some of these arguments too. And if we've got a more diffuse London where we've got more nodes of economic activity in, you know, the suburbs, places like Ealing and Harrow and Barnet, we'll have a fairer, more distributed city. And that surely is a better model than we've currently got, whereby, you know, central London is overheating and faces all of the challenges of, you know, supply chains and value that are currently hollowing it out.
So just finally, 5 years' time,
yep.
where do you see Ealing being?
Well, it'll be in West London, approximately, you know, to...
How will its economy have changed? What kind of... Yeah. When you're looking back in 20 years, what do you think the next 5 years will bring to Ealing?
Look, I think one of the things that politicians quite often do is judge their success by, you know, the plaques that are on the walls and the buildings.
How many statues are going to be to you around Ealing?
No, hopefully there'll be none, right? Okay. The measure of a success in the London Borough of Ealing is the experience of an average family in terms of the life chances that they've got in front of them. You know, were they able to enjoy a happy, healthy life? Were the kids able to get a great education? Were they able to grow old and experience a community that supports them and loves them and gives them a sense of pride, identity and purpose? Those are the incredibly important things. What that will mean for Ealing is that we will be a fairer borough in which people can get employment locally, where each of our seven town centres and the seven economies of our borough have a sense of who they are, what they're achieving and what opportunity looks like. And that London as a whole will be a bit fairer and a bit more distributed, where it won't be the case that your only chance at getting a decent job is to spend, you know, an hour on a sweltering central line or a Piccadilly line heading off to Soho. Yeah. We've all been there, haven't we? Yeah. You know, and I get the great joy of, you know, of working where I live, leading my borough, and it's a great quality of life. But, you know, the city that we enjoy collectively as Londoners is one that has flexibility and openness and pride and identity. So, you know, I don't want to set a metric that says X
has to be delivered,
X has to be delivered, or Y to be achieved. Yeah. You know, politics, governance, change is that gradual process of making people's lives that bit better. Mm-hmm. And if we'll have done that for as many people as we possibly could have done, then that will be the achievement in and of itself.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Councillor. So now we have one last question.
Oh,
because I think this will become a pub quiz tiebreaker somewhere. It certainly was in our office when we discussed it.
Yeah.
Can you please name the seven town centres of Ealing? No pressure.
Acton, Ealing, Greenford, Hanwell, Perivale, Northolt, Southolt.
We did it. Thank you very much for your time today.
Say the best to last.
Indeed. Thank you.